representing from the front lines, as it were. Now, all of you in this room are already on the front lines. Mine is a different part of the front lines. You think of it as a battle, as a war. We know who the enemy is. I'm a bit like C.S. Lewis when he looked out over the scope of what had to be done, and he looked where he thought the line was weakest, and that's where he went. And God has been driving me and pushing me in certain directions, and I feel in some ways that I'm like that guy who's always shadowing where the enemy is going next. Where's the line weakest today? So I went to Concordia University, but I had 12 years of Lutheran education before that. Within about 2 months of my time at Concordia Macron, I became an atheist, lost the right to be a pastor. Now, the LCMS is still one of those denominations where it still wants you to believe in God, preferably. So, I knew that this was a problem at the time, certainly from a good point of view, but personally, too. Personally, I felt that I was being asked to give up something significant about my identity. All those years coming up, and thinking through how I wanted to invest the rest of my life. So there was about 4 to 6 months there where I was really, I don't even really have the words for it. But the Lord worked in that time. And as I emerged from that experience, one of the convictions that I had was that I wanted to invest my life in trying to help people avoid the kinds of crisis of faith that I had. A crisis of faith is a very natural thing. Everyone has them in different ways as they get older. But there's a healthy crisis of faith, and then there was what I had. In the crisis of faith that I had, the reason why it was unhealthy was because it was unnecessary. It was unwanted. I was thrown off by something as simple and as minor as Bible contradictions. And not the really hard ones either. I mean, the really easy ones. So what happened? Well, about the first 4 to 6 weeks of my time there at Concordia was the first time after 12 years a Christian Lutheran education that I had read the Bible for myself. I began to synthesize the process of what I was reading. And so I tripped over the small things, then I tripped over the big things. Before too long, I was pretty well gone. That was in the fall of 1992. So fast forward now. Several years of Lutheran education, taught Greek many years ago at a small Lutheran Bible college in Rockford that no one here has probably ever heard of. They're no longer in existence. Before gravitating to Wisconsin to raise my family. And in 2008, I officially opened up the Thanatos Christian Ministries, an apologetics ministry. And something was going on around 2006-2008 that prompted me to realize that almost every person that I was working with, I'm talking about the non-Christians, was raised in the church. Almost every single one. That made me sit down and really think about what I was doing. How I was doing it. I mean, think of a brick wall. This is your typical atheist. And then there was me. Bam. I mean, I just loved going after these guys. The hardest of hearts was the one that I wanted to talk to, in part because I sympathized with what they had, because I felt that I'd gone through it too. But then to find out that all these atheists, these hardcore disbelievers, had been raised in the church like I had, made me think that I needed to change my approach. Think about where I was doing my apologetics ministry. Perhaps it might be a better idea to defend the faith within the church before they become hardcore atheists than once they get out. That was our thought. So in 2007, I put out a press release, kind of insanely, and I declared in this press release that the church was creating atheists. And I didn't really think of anything. I sent out the press release, I went to bed, and I woke up the next morning, and everybody wanted to talk to me. And Bob Duco and the Detroit radio station there, and some other people out on the East Coast and the West Coast, and radio stations called me up left and right, my website was getting bombarded. It was a weird time. If I were to make a claim like that today, it would not be controversial. No one would want to talk to me. No one would think that I had anything new to bring to the table, any new perspective. And I think that's testimony to how quickly things are changing right underneath our feet. So I'm here to present, as it were, a report from a different part of the front lines. You are on the front lines, of course, in a different way. In your careers and in your ministries, you deal with people from cradle to grave in one context. And up until a couple years ago, I dealt with the ones who had walked out of the church and never to return. But now as I've come back and I've turned it around and I've refocused my ministry to the church itself, I have some new perspectives that I'm going to try to present to you a little bit today. And a lot of this is going to be autobiographical. I have to confess. So let's start with the situation where we're at right now. Pastor Shockley went around with a little half-sheet flyer. So this is the growth of the religiously unaffiliated. These are going to be people who are atheists, of course, but they could be anyone who doesn't state a religious belief of some kind. Now, if you notice, prior to 1980, that line remains pretty flat. It hovers around that 8% or so. And then, a little dip there right after 1990, and then it's up and away, still going up. It is now 25% of the population of the United States, the adult population, who says they are unaffiliated. Now, if you drill down into these stats, and I do have, I provide some resources on this sheet at the bottom, some books. America's changing religious landscape. Christians declined sharply as share of the population as of May 12, 2015. Then a more recent one, which is where this chart comes from, is Exodus, why Americans are leaving religion, why they're unlikely to come back. If you dig into those figures, the actual reports, it's really troubling to see how many of them say that it was things within their church, within their congregation, the fact that they were in the church to begin with, and then walked away. That number is still very high, the people who say that they're atheists or whatnot, who are raised in the church. But the number is getting smaller, because the church is getting smaller, and the people who are left have already left. Now, way back when in 92, 95, 98, 99, when I was teaching, the understanding was that when a person left the congregation, they're probably going to come back. They're going to grow older, they're going to have kids. Those kids are going to grow older, and then one day, the parents will wake up and say, that was more important than I realized, and then they come back. The statistics are showing that they're not coming back. That's what that last study shows, that Exodus, why Americans are leaving religion, why they're likely to come back. That's just from September 22nd, 2016, just a couple weeks ago. So people are beginning to take note of this. This is something that drives us to wonder what has happened on our watch. It's not necessarily to say that we're to blame or it's our fault. What is going on, is happening. We have the opportunity to look around and explore this phenomena that is unfolding in front of us and try to understand it. Because it is happening on our watch. And we can see, just from listening to the conversations that were going on before I came up, I think everyone knows that this country is heading in a direction that's not going to be sympathetic to the Christian religion for too much longer. If you flip that over, that piece of paper, I thought it might be interesting to see where we are in the LCMS. At the very bottom, you can see the LCMS there. In 2007, the LCMS made up 1.4% of the adult population. In 2014, it had dropped by 0.3%. And the comforting thing is, if it can be comforting, is almost every Christian church in the country is going through the same thing. Every denomination, with some exceptions here and there. What has happened? What is going on? To answer that, and to give an argument for apologetics in general, and give you some direction on where to further your study into this, I think we need to broaden what we think about when we think about apologetics. I'm sure everyone here has an opinion or, well, no one here has opinions, right? Everyone here knows exactly all there is to know about it. Its place in the church, its place in conversion, if it has any place at all. Let me tell you the way I see it. There's that passage in 1 Corinthians about how some sow, they plant, some water, and others reap. None of those three things are on my job. I'm that guy who goes into the field, the department has just said, I want to plant in that field. I'm the guy who looks at it and says, man, there's a lot of rocks in that field. That field hasn't been worked in. I'm the one who gets the cowman, rolls it in, dumps it out, gets the pitchfork, starts getting slow already. The work that I do is almost always trying to find out what's standing in the way, what's keeping them from receiving the gospel. Usually it boils down to some kind of personal rebellion, despite whatever arguments that they make. But essentially, my point is, to do this kind of work means to think about the soil. The parable of the good seed. Some of it fell in, well, it's good seed. It's good seed, it's the gospel. Some fell into good soil, some fell into thorny soil. Can we do anything to help improve the soil? Is that not our concern at all? Is there going to be no one who does that? Well, farmers, I live in kind of a rural area now, I kind of have more firsthand experience with this. About two or three times a year, I smell what farmers do to get their soil ready. I smell some on the way here. Apologetics is helping to make good soil so that others can come along and do the other parts of God's work. The soil is getting worse, getting toxic. Someone has come along, not just thrown in weed seeds, but they've dumped chemicals in it. They've hauled rocks in from who knows where, thrown them in there overnight. We wake up the next morning, we saw the field, it was one way, and now we have even more work to do than we had when we laid our heads down to rest. Some of the studies that you're going to look at if you begin to research this going to give you all of the things you might expect for why people walk away from the faith. Problems with pain, Bible contradictions. The big one these days is the church's stance on sexuality that's turning off a lot of young people. But, if you dig deeper, you find tantalizing clues, like in Kent Ham's book, Already Gone, A Special of Hands. Is anyone familiar with this book by Kent Ham, Already Gone? All right, a good number, it's good. The point of the book, the title is Already Gone, because he was exploring, he wanted to know why all these people were deep in the faith. And he was exploring this idea that people go off to college and have a crisis of faith and they walk away. And he found out by looking at thousands of people who had walked away from the faith that they were mostly already gone before they got to college. This really caught him by surprise. But when I read that, I believe the book was out in 2009, I really resonated with it. Because I spent a lot of time talking with college kids back in those times. You are a really sophisticated unbeliever. I mean, you're only a freshman and you've already walked away so far. And of course, it's kind of my own story, right? Well, Ken Ham, of course, pins it on Darwinism. The widespread acceptance of Darwinism. I agree with him. But I think it runs far deeper than it. If you look back through the course of history since Darwin, there was a transition that occurred. Most of the ideas that fueled disbelief prior to Darwin still exist today. The difference is, today, when people raise those objections, they consider them scientific facts. If you're familiar with Richard Dawkins, he made a comment once. He said, Darwin made it possible to be intellectually satisfied atheists. People are getting the idea, and have been for about a century, that religion is not just false, but it is widely discredited. That if you really wanted to believe something true, then you would turn to science. That's where it's at. Now in this context, I want you to think about what has happened in, shall we call, areas of sexual liberty, so on and so forth. If you are a Darwinist, if you believe that we evolved from pond sludge, and you begin going out into the world and thinking about who you're going to have as your mate, are you going to think there's anything sacred at all about the man-woman relationship? Well, why would you? If you look at the animal kingdom, there's all sorts of different ways to reproduce. There's all kinds of different sexual arrangements. Sky's the limit. So people today are just acting according to what they have been taught. And they have been taught that it is rock hard scientific fact. This attitude, this is an attitude, not an argument, is what confronts us. Now I led with that example. Because one of the things that surfaces as you begin trying to understand why people have walked away from the faith is that, this is going to be kind of obvious, the role of the mother and the father in transmitting that faith is critical. It's paramount. Barna, in his book, Unchristian, tracks all this, has a section called Fatherless Generation. He notes in about 2007 that most of the people that he talks to who have left the faith are fatherless. There's no man in that house. The report that I said before, Exodus, the PRI one from 2016, says that their surveys now show they're one of the few to actually kind of look at it and study it, that a high percentage of the people who have walked away from the faith in the last 20 to 40 years were themselves the products of divorced, broken households. I want you to consider that. Think about that. Because it's easy to get caught up if we're going to have a conversation about apologetics. I'm all in favor of that. That's what I've been doing for a long time. But there's no argument that I can bring to the table, that I can take into the household of a 10-year-old whose parents are having a custody battle over him, when that young man or woman is having their ideas of what it means to have a loving father totally reworked, perhaps, especially if that father is abusive, neglected, or just not there. Now you're going to try to tell this young person when they get a little bit older that God is a loving father? There's no apologetic argument for that. There's cause for healing. We need to be able to sift through what they're telling us, find out what's really going on in their heart. Many times they won't tell you the reasons, and they might not even know it themselves. But a lot of it has to do with the fact that they were not raised in the faith to begin with. If you would kindly look at this chart one more time. I wonder if anybody else's attention was caught by the timing of that lives, right around 1992-94. I remember looking at this. I've looked at this data for like 10 years, but when I was getting ready for this, I looked at this again, and I'm like, what happened in 92 besides Clinton? Even he's not that fast. And I racked my brain. I really dug into this. What could it be? School system. Well, schools are not that fast either. What could possibly account for this? And I realized, as I sifted through everything, that this was approximately the time when all of the children who were born in the 70s and no-fault divorce became the law of the land across this country. That's when these children were beginning to come of age. And I began putting together the fact that I was raised in a broken family. My parents were divorced in the early 80s. When I got to college, I can't point to my family upbringing as wounding me and a spiritual upbringing. But had they been present and informed and equipped, and had we had intense conversations about the Bible, theology, philosophy, politics, you name it, and they knew what they were talking about, I don't think I would have ever had that crisis of faith. And I was fortunate, I think, that I had a great group of friends who stood by me when I had those questions, just hung with me, began reading C.S. Lewis, G.K. Chesterton, and I began to come around through this. I was very fortunate. Some other fathers, as it were, came into the picture. Through the course of this sort of the vignette, I guess, as it were, about my own crisis of faith and the possible role of divorce, you can see that in a way, this group here, is perhaps more closely positioned to do something about this great falling away, this anti-revival, I call it, than even someone like I am. Perhaps the most important things that you do in the course of your ministry is helping parents stay married, helping them have healthy, happy relationships. It's something to think about. But I bet you didn't That is the cultivation of good soil. Because let's face it, none of you can be the fathers of all the children in your congregation. You are finite creatures. That means looking at the fathers and recognizing that in them, this person has to become not just the figurehead, spiritual head of the household, but the actual head of that household. That father needs to know the scriptures inside and out. As well as you, maybe not, but pretty good. That father has to know what is being taught in the schools. Because Darwinism, of course, is taught all the way early on. I've got some kids in public school. I homeschool one. Never seen one of them. They know when that science class comes around what Dad thinks about that Darwinism stuff. I assure you. But it's not just about knowing that it's there, but having an answer. Here's why. Here's what's wrong with it. Here are the consequences. Here are the implications. And if that family is a battleground, I don't care what kind of Bible education you do, that's a losing battle. That's apologetics too. Defending the faith by defending the family. Defending the faith by defending life. You can't proclaim the gospel to people who are dead. I mean actually dead. Because they're aborted. You can't proclaim the faith effectively to young people who are worried about who's going to be picking them up after confirmation class. Is it mom today? Is it dad today? And I'm not speaking lightly. That was my life. My life was a battleground. Not all the time, but much of the time. I have time to think about these things. The statistics show that these anecdotes are rooted in reality. I don't know what you're going to do with it per se within your own congregation, but it is something that you absolutely must take seriously. If you want to promote the transmission of the faith to the next generation, you have to look at the health of the families that are in your congregation. It's almost a central thing that I want to communicate this whole time. This is what I've been fixating on in my mind for almost a month as I've been thinking about this. Because I can talk about the pain, philosophy, Aquinas, quantum mechanics, microevolution, multiverse. You can do all that. But there's nothing more important than healthy, happy families, the transmission of the faith from one generation to the next. So how do we get here? This is the other thing that I wanted to tell you. No Fault Divorce was brought into this country by a group called the American Law Institute. Is anyone familiar with the LI here? Okay. This is a group of legal geniuses going back to right around 1920. They were a group of progressives who understood that if they wanted to transform this country, they could do nothing until they transformed the family. Lots of big names in this group. They paid out high. In the 1960s, they began writing model laws. Politicians love model laws, because that means less work for them. Someone just shows up, say, here's the law. All the smart people already worked through all the contingencies. This thing will pass constitutional muster. By golly, just pass it. And I believe in 1970, ironically, Governor Ronald Reagan passed the first no fault law in California. Almost every state in the union followed suit. By around 1980, and I believe now only a couple states might be hanging out. All because of this group. And Nobody, I didn't see any hands go up. All because this group of progressives, right around 1965, decided that they were going to transform marriage. To transform the family. Right around that same time, the ALI also produced model legislation that made it, let me get the details right here. In the prison system, the government would pay for abortions, but only in the prison system. Damn, that's okay. Next thing you know, California adopted it, swept the land. And you see how the argument went. Well, a lot of people for abortions in the prison system. Why not do it here? Why not? What's wrong with it if we're already paying for it? Short story. Only a few years later, Roe v. Wade, 1973. The ALI. This group of the ones I've heard of. What I'm getting at with this is what I want you to understand is the things that have been happening the last 30 or 40 years. I've been bringing you a report from the front lines as it were. They're not accidental. They're intentional. And they're foreseen. We didn't maybe put it together, but they understood it. And they put it together. I'm not the first to have observed it. Noticed it. Francis Schaeffer, most of you probably heard that name. He tried to warn people in the 70s about what was happening. Before him, C.S. Lewis, The Abolition of Man, that hideous strength, he saw it, knew it was coming. G.K. Chesterton, 1922, eugenics and other evils, described the intentional fracture in the family that was in the author. And yet, despite all of this, despite all the forces working against us, thinking about how we're going to transmit faith to the next generation, other people thought, well, we'll see about that. And I don't blame us. I don't blame Christians. We get accused all the time of meddling in politics, but we're not actually the ones who are thinking about politics all the time. If it were up to us, we would spend our lives happily with our families, doing our jobs, reaching out to our community, and that would be good enough. The people who have set these wheels in motion, we can call them different things, progressives, liberals, secular humanists, we go by a variety of different terms we can call them. They want to perfect society. That's their goal. But they don't believe in God. God's not part of them. And they believe that Darwinism has given them the tools, the methods, the mechanisms for manipulating folks. For them, everything is political, including marriage. Now, this sheet again. What you're looking at here is called the job memo. It was sent by a gentleman by the name of Robert Jaffa to Bernard Berelson right around 1969. Let me just give you a minute to kind of scan through. So Jaffa was the vice president of Planned Parenthood's Population Division. Bernard Berelson was the president of the Population Council, a group that had been formed by leftovers of the eugenics, the American eugenics movement of the 1930s through the 1950s, give or take. It was no longer politically sensible to identify yourself as a eugenicist anymore. In 1950, you probably figured out why. And so they began looking about for other things. One of the things they did was found this population council. They decided that there was too many people in the world. Too many people. A lot of the, I see some people here who might be in a shade older than I am. Just a few more gray hairs. otherwise it's a young God, but some of you who were possibly alive during this time, remember the population bomb, the population explosion, and so on and so forth. Well, that's all part of the same package. And the reason why I like this document is because it's all on one page. You hear on one sheet, in their own words, the kinds of things that they were contemplating doing to American society in 1969. I'm not saying they decided to do all these things, but I'm sure you looked through this list and you said, well, wait a minute, some of these things sound kind of familiar. I'm not saying that, yeah, they decided to embrace all of them, but they were all on the table. What does it mean to you? Well, Harrelson took the information that Jaffa sent him, along with some other folks, and he went to John D. Rockefeller III, and the two of them managed to convince Nixon to pass a population control bill here in the United States. It's still on the books. The Office of Population Affairs, you can go to their website right now and check it out. God bless Richard Nixon. At that point, government money, to the tunes of billions of dollars, began funneling through that legislation down to the states, charted and given shape and direction by people with this mentality. If you wondered why it was so hard to keep families together, well, maybe it had something to do with the fact that there were millions and billions of dollars going in programs deliberately meant to undercut your efforts. And I say this because, having been in this kind of work for 15, 20 years, a lot of times the proposals and the things that we talk about happen in a vacuum. Oh, let's just have a conversation about, you know, having a program that will do this and that. Well, that's fine, but what if every time you set up a program that you thought met a need in your community, every time you did that, some other group over here came and secretly, using taxpayer dollars, tried to undermine it. That's largely what was happening. If you go through this list of things that they were willing to consider, your eye probably was caught by the restructuring of the family, postponing or avoiding marriage. Marriage rate has dropped all-time lows. Alter image of ideal family size. The average child per family, I believe now is at 1.8 in the United States. Compulsory education of children, well, we've got that. And that encourage increased homosexuality, educate family limitation. These are the things that probably caught your eye. But look over to the right under social controls, housing policies, discouragement of private home ownership. You know the home ownership is at an all-time low as well in America? They want to reduce the population. They want to restructure the family. What does discouragement of private home ownership have anything to do with that? Jaffa memo. I didn't come here to talk about that, just to kind of illustrated. Jaffa, Berylson, and Rockefeller worked together on the Rockefeller Commission report, also brought, which called upon to get women to work, because if women are working, they can't be good, they can't be at home, so on and so forth. Women will voluntarily not have children because they're working, so on and so forth. And Nixon continued to fund that. It has been funded continually through every president, whether Republican or Democrat, ever since. So we're not doing this in a vacuum. We're going to have to be at the top of our game. Everything is political to them, and then they say, keep your religion out of politics. Reminds me of that bit by C.S. Lewis, where he says, you know what we're going to do? We're going to get so religion is what you do in your quiet time. And then we'll make sure there's no quiet. This is what's coming upon us. And they're going after the children. They know that's where their future lies. And we know that statistically, a person raised in a broken home is going to lean towards disbelief. So we know that the stakes are high. We're going to cultivate good soil for our good message. We have to be on the top of our game. We have to look at that family, the families in our midst, and think not just about the programs, like the information that we're going to give them, but is everything all right at home? How can we help? What can we do? If I may be so bold, one of the reasons why I didn't become a pastor, because I was in the Priest-Not program, was because I was offended by the idea that there was nothing else for me as a man to do in the church. I can be an usher. I might be able to lead some Bible studies. I don't know why, but as a young man, I just thought that rubbed me the wrong way. Because I didn't think that I wanted to be a pastor or that I was called to be a pastor. But I knew that God was calling me to work. And I saw nothing in the church for someone like me. When I look at the men that I've interacted with in the congregations, folks like me are not pastors. To tell you the truth, they don't think they're the spiritual heads of their households. They think you are. I know there's exceptions. Of course there's exceptions. But of course, they're not going to tell all of you necessarily. They might tell me, because I'm sitting next to you. I tell you this because men need to be encouraged to step up to their responsibilities. They need to know that what they're doing is important, that they're being trusted with important work, that they can get into nooks and crannies that you are not able to reach. You just couldn't, even if you wanted to. To tell them, that if they are not spiritual heads of their household, chances are they're going to lose those kids. I gave this presentation probably about 5 years ago. I was speaking on the historicity of the resurrection, the stone, one of my favorite presentations, kind of like a forensic look at the resurrection. Who stole Jesus' body? I was inspired by Frank Morrison. He has a book by the same name. And this gentleman came and he said to me, you know, I've got, I think it was about 6 kids. He says, I put every single one of my kids through Lutheran education. All but one has left the faith. How do I save the last one? been doing. Here's a guy who thought the Lutheran education system was going to do everything that needed to be done. Later that night, I went out to coffee with the guy who had invited me to give that presentation in a couple of young persons. And one of the young persons, he's over and says to me, "No one knows this yet, but I've decided to become an atheist. I'm an atheist." So we talked for a little bit. We went through whatever it was that he had going on. Driving back with the guy, and he says, "That was that guy's last son. The one that he thought he still had." I just couldn't believe it. That this would happen right underneath this guy's nose. And he was obviously concerned about it. He cared about it a great deal. But you know what? He had never heard any of the things that I had said in that night's presentation. He had never heard an argument for the resurrection, from the evidence, from the history, whatever it might be, about Pontius Pilate, what kind of a man he was. He didn't know that. He thought Pontius Pilate was a nice guy. He didn't know anything about what filing proceedings may have said about him. It was all new to him. He didn't know any of that stuff. So when his kid says to me, "You know, I think there probably isn't a God, but if there is, we can make paths to him." I'm sure he never said that to his father, and if he had, his father would have never had a clue what to say in response to that. I give this anecdote to kind of illustrate that this is not a miracle cure. Happy, healthy families. This was a happy, healthy, intact family in the Lutheran school system. And yet they had lost about a half dozen kids to disbelief. That guy didn't know, did not realize, that he was the primary transmitter of the Christian faith in that household. So my question, if I may be so bold to put before about it. Where are people getting this idea from? That's for you to work through. I'm only bringing you a report from my part of the front lines. Tomorrow I'm going to give you a more conventional apologetics presentation. I'm going to give you some ideas on what the contemporary challenges to the Christian faith are. Darwinism, I mentioned, there are others too. Specific places and areas where you're going to want to be informed and make sure that your congregation is informed and equipped as well. But it was very important to me that I got this off my chest. That before we get through to any of that other stuff, there's just nothing more profound than the fact that God made a man and a woman to be one flesh and Malachi 2. It says, "Why did he make one flesh? So that there may be godly offspring." God built into the family the mechanism for the transmission of faith. And we have watched it collapse right in front of our eyes over the last 30 or 40 years. So now we're dealing with an unbelieving generation of broken people. Tomorrow I'll address that. So I've left a little bit of time here, right? How much time? 5 minutes? 15, right. That was intentional. I'm hoping that there are questions or comments or things that I can react to.
Jim Schultz, Our Savior's Lutheran Church here in Sheboygan. Do you see any connection between the rise in, or the growth in religiously unaffiliated with the growth in membership in the non-denominational churches in America?
Yes, but it's not as strong as you want to think. The data that has been coming out has been showing that to begin with, say 2000 to 2005 or so, and I've looked at a great number of studies from 2000 in that range. A lot of the people who were leaving the faith, the mainline denominations, we'll say, and they were still religious to some degree. And there was a number of studies that actually said, you know, okay, we see this happening, but don't be too worried because they're still religious. That's gone. They're just skipping right over that now. The latest studies that I've seen, there's one out of 2013. It's the ARIS study, American Religious Identification Survey. It was done by a gentleman, his name escapes me, but he's also a head of the Secularist Society. ARIS is a more mainline kind of thing, but he did a secondary study that showed that the people who are leaving the faith now in the last 10 years, since 2005-ish, they're not going to any churches at all. They are just gone, just flat out gone. And I think that has something to do with the fact that in the 95 to 2010 range, there was still a lot of social capital. People were uneasy and a little bit nervous about leaving their faith. I mean, that's a hard break for a lot of people. But now it's much more societal. It's more socially acceptable to walk away, and so they just stop.
One of the things I've noticed, I had a conversation a couple months ago with a gentleman, a young father, and he asked me when he's on the road, where can he go? Luther Outreach Ministries has their men's network, which is not capital. It's pretty solid theology, pretty solid Bible study. But one of the things he had said to me that bothered him, and this is kind of an indictment on some of us as pastors, the kind of Bible study he got from his pastor doesn't equip him for dealing with the issues that his children are running into. And I said, well, why don't you talk to your pastor about it? And he says, well, he just doesn't want to do anything that's more extensive because it's too much work and people don't always understand. I've always had the principle in mind that my job is to raise the level, not to keep it at the lowest possible denominator, but get it up to the highest possible. And I think that's part of our issue too in the church. When we're teaching parents, especially fathers, we don't always give them what they need.
Yeah, thanks. Well, a lot of thoughts in response to that. Bonhoeffer said when Christ calls man, he bids him come and die. And I don't think that people are getting the impression that being a Christian is all that dangerous, really. That it's just our opinion, it's just the way we live our lives, and there's nothing better or superior. And I think this is important for a man, because they want to know that they're part of something big and they're doing something important. And if you don't channel them, they will just go away. And telling them, really putting this card down their shoulders and making it clear that it's them or no one, as it were, I think it might have a better impact. It might pick up a few people, but I think in the main, they're going to be glad for it. They'll be glad for it.
This comes a little bit out of your testimony. When you said you went to college and began studying and reading the Word for the first time yourself, why was that, what happened in your educational training or upbringing that prevented that from being a part of who you were and how you functioned? I don't know quite how to say that. Sometimes we end up teaching the doctrine. We don't teach the Word that supports the doctrine, or we don't teach it faithfully enough.
So, just so everyone knows, I'll be here after this, and I'm happy to talk to everyone for as long as they want to talk to me. I'm happy to do so on my own service. Because that question can go on and on and on and on. have to worry that someone's going to go on a web page and find 30 reasons why Christianity is wrong and why your teacher is stupid. You had three television stations, maybe four in the 80s, so they're in the, TV was pretty sane by comparison. So there wasn't a lot of competition for ideas. So you could get away with that. But then in the 90s, that all blew apart. There's a lot more competition for eyeballs. But why wasn't I reading the Bible for myself before that? Most of my teachers, they weren't even religion teachers. They were PE or biology. I'm not trying to say anything bad about this. Paul, please, understand me. But the idea that that particular position was crucially important in its own right, I think really revealed itself. The teachers weren't prepared. They used a lot of canned stuff. Those blue bristle grass, one of those things, remember those? Good grief. It just screamed cheap. Yeah, but there's a lot more I can say about that.
Any other questions?
So how can a pastor best equip the fathers in his congregation to be the spiritual leader in their household?
I will be here all night. You probably all noticed that it's practically impossible to get anyone to show up for a meeting. So, what I would suggest is finding one father and just meet with him. Just start with the one and just harass the heck out of him. Just pester him, show up at his workplace, show up wherever, just go after him, don't relent. And after you've persuaded him and equipped him, tell him to go do it to another guy, and you pick another guy. Because it kind of goes back to the raising the level kind of thing. I think that a lot of guys, they just don't think it's their job. They just don't think so. And until they hear that, here's the other thing that happens. I know this from experience. Here's a problem. If the pastor steps in, or any person steps in, and does it for him, he will never do it himself. Come on. If my wife does the dishes, she leaves them there long enough, and I notice she does them, I won't do them. It's the same thing. Every time we step in and do something that they're for them, that they're supposed to be doing themselves, we enable them. And men are very glad to be enabled, in my experience. I should have written the recording this now. I'm in trouble.
Well, while I'm going back there, I guess I have a question about, I've noticed in my years of ministry that there is an increasing sort of general anti-intellectualism among people. They're just not interested as much in learning from books or learning from the Bible, etc. You want to say anything about that?
No, I think that's very profound. I think that it's tied very much to the permanence that Darwinism has obtained. God made people whether they liked it or not, so they still have this sense that there's a spiritual order, but what they don't think is there could possibly be any truth to it. So truth becomes whatever they feel inside. They look at the universe, they see the stars, and they're in awe, and that's enough for them. They don't have to think any further beyond that, so they won't. Yeah.
As the head of the family should teach it in a simple way to his household, should the pastor be teaching Luther's catechism?
Maybe in a simple way, and then have the father do it in the advanced, more complicated way. Yeah, I mean, I know what you're saying. This is built into our theology that the father's supposed to be doing this. Let me wrap this up with another anecdote. End this on time.
Okay, one question.
Yes, oh, sir. All right then.
Actually, I'm trying to sneak in too. When you talk about the age, when they come of age, are you talking about prior to 20, you're talking about early teens or late mid-teens or 20, when is the age that you're referring to? Kids come of age? Since 1980?
Right around 18 to 20.
18 to 20.
Okay. And they're already gone by their high school graduation.
Okay, this is the second one. Have you noticed anything that is regional about this at all, from certain areas of the country that tend to be more of havens for this or not? I came across the statistic not too long ago on how accurate it is. It has nothing to do with, I think, where it came from, but it was talking about one of the more normal states in the country where there are more private own homes in the state of Indiana than anywhere else in the country?
Yeah, I can't say that I have studied that dimension to give you a very good answer. But I could confidently say that in regions where there are more stable, happy, healthy families, chances are pretty good that they are not yet psychotic. That would be just a first punch kind of thing. I would kind of turn it and shape it as kind of a hopeful thing, though, because what it means is that, yes, the other side of the people on the other side of this are working nationally, even internationally, on a top-down kind of thing. And we are being squeezed at the bottom, but there's still a lot that we can do locally, too. We can work within our community where they can't get into every nook and cranny either. So it's not hopeless, but we do have to be proactive. So let me close with an anecdote, another autobiographical element. So I mentioned that I'm a father of four, and my oldest, I mentioned that he's being homeschooled. The other two, got two in the public school system. But my daughter, when she was in the womb, was diagnosed with spinal bifida. While we were sitting there, like just as the news was delivered, the doctor said in so many words, "Do you want to kill it?" And birth defect. You know, fill in the gap. We said no. Absolutely not. My wife very emphatically shut that down. As we reflected on that, a few weeks after that, I was horrified, first of all, that anyone could put a question like that to people in that kind of a state. There was that. And my research into that is actually what brought me into this, because getting rid of the weak and the disabled and those who cost the government a lot of money is part of the program. So I learned a lot of that. But as I reflected on that, I came across all these stories people who had said yes, kill it, after just that one second. And I realized how important it was at that moment that we think through these things well in advance, before the situation is upon us. I was about 35 years old, give or take at that time. No, I wasn't. I was younger than that. It never occurred to me that my action on a given day could actually result in death of my parents. Just never crossed my mind. The people who just say yes, kill it, they're just overwhelmed by everything that's coming at them. They're not grounded on anything that can hold them up as the news washes over them. And I tell you this story because the fruits of that decision, the conviction that my wife and I had at that moment, were laid and established years and years and years and years and years before with Pastor Ralph Fisher by my teachers, even by my parents in their own way. I said before that this work of apologetics is like going out and putting manure down and You don't get to reap a lot of harvest in your manure. But I wanted you to know that because of your work, you just don't know. A few years down the line, someone else might be in that ultrasound room, and they also might come to that life and death moment, and they will make an act that saves a life. This too is apologetics. So, with that, thank you very much for your time.